Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and there are other benefits to infrastructure besides simply getting us where we want to go safely and allowing our toilets to flush. According to my next guest, social infrastructure around cities and suburbs can help repair our social and even political divides. Now, I wouldn't let anyone make such a lofty claim, but Eric Kleinenberg has the research chops to back it up. He's a professor of sociology and director of the Institute for Public Knowledge at NYU, has a number of fabulous groundbreaking books to his credit already, and his new one is called Palaces for the People: How Social Infrastructure Can Help Fight Inequality, Polarization, and the Decline of Civic Life. He also writes about President Trump promoting what he calls antisocial infrastructure and more. So, Eric, welcome back to WNYC.
So nice to be here. Thank you.
So this idea of social infrastructure, the physical places that shape the way we interact, really came out of your first book, Heat Wave, which was an analysis of the 1995 Chicago heat wave. We've written several books since then. What is social infrastructure, and what brought you back to the topic now?
Yeah, well, social infrastructure are the places that shape our interactions, put quite simply, and it's just as real as the infrastructure we rely on to carry water or electricity or people in transit, crowded or not, late or not. When social infrastructure is robust, it makes it much more likely that we will engage one another casually, informally, or in a planned way. It leads to relationships and social bonds. But when we neglect the social infrastructure, we grow more isolated and alone.
Give our listeners a couple of examples. I know libraries feature prominently in the book. Why do you call that social infrastructure, and what else goes in that category?
Yeah, so libraries, public parks and playgrounds are places where people get to know each other quite well. Childcare centers, athletic fields. In the commercial sector, obviously places like coffee shops and taverns, beauty salons can do that. But the more open they are and the more accessible, the better they'll be. We know from that Starbucks story in Philadelphia this year that a Starbucks can very quickly turn into a hostile environment. I came back to this topic after Hurricane Sandy. And, you know, in some ways it's appropriate that we're talking about this on September 11th because Sandy was an event that introduced to us a new set of security concerns. I started writing about it right away and wound up serving as the research director for President Obama's Rebuild by Design competition, which was an idea to try to generate exciting ideas for 21st century infrastructure. The challenge for us was, how do we not only make New York City safe, but also make it a better place to be every day?
So, for example, you visited a library in East New York, and you found that the staff there was going above and beyond what people might think of as librarian work.
Oh my goodness. Librarians are doing so many different kinds of work that I think most of us don't appreciate. Librarians are providing early literacy education for the youngest members of our community. They're hosting virtual bowling leagues on Xbox for older people who might otherwise end up isolated. They are doing instruction for English as a second language. And they're dealing with a lot of problems that get pushed into libraries because we haven't invested enough in those other programs. So every morning you will find people who struggle with mental illness, who are homeless, who are looking for companionship, or who are in schools that no longer have libraries internally because we've cut the budget. They're all being sent to our branch libraries.
What's antisocial infrastructure?
Well, there's nothing so antisocial as the wall. It's a place that further divides and separates us. It's the most crude kind of infrastructure we have. And so I think it is really time for us to start thinking about what infrastructure could deliver us the benefits we need, not just for protection, but also for bridging divisions. There are certain kinds of places that make it much more likely that we can recognize the humanity in people with whom we disagree politically. But there are also certain kinds of infrastructures that help those of us who live in this segregated and divided society get to know people from other backgrounds and places. It's such essential work.
Is there, across the political divide, social infrastructure that you would cite then? If a wall is antisocial infrastructure, you know, just because you go to a library, well, people tend to live in neighborhoods with politically like-minded people increasingly in this country. So that's not across the divide social infrastructure in that way. Do you have examples of things that are?
Absolutely. And, you know, I grew up in Chicago. I lived in New York City for 20 years, but Chicago is such a segregated city, and the solution to the problems of segregation in Chicago is not to just spend time in your neighborhood public library unless there are other people who are there. But there are certain kinds of places that bring us together. You know, I teach in a university, but schools and college campuses, community college campuses, such essential social infrastructures for bringing people from different walks of life together in a place where they will make consequential decisions about how to spend their time, what to learn, what to do next, and relationships will naturally grow in places like that. My son, who is a great soccer player, plays on the Metropolitan Oval Club in Massbeth, Queens, and it's an amazing place, one of the oldest soccer clubs in New York City, and there are people from all over the region who get together several days a week. We're there because we love our children and we want to watch them play. But in the process of spending all this time together, we get to know each other and build relationships, even though we disagree about so many things.
Eric Kleinenberg with us from the NYU Institute for Public Knowledge. He directs that and he's the author now of Palaces for the People, How Social Infrastructure Can Help Fight Inequality, Polarization, and the Decline of Civic Life. And we can take a few phone calls for him. If you have a really good example of social infrastructure in your life, is it a park, a library, a public pool? Call in and tell us your favorite place to not be atomized in your life and how the infrastructure helps you do it. Or if you have a question, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. One social infrastructure concept that's key to your book, and always a big topic with our listeners, is broken windows policing. And that's not, you know, when Mayor de Blasio came in running against Stop and Frisk, Stop and Frisk in the Bloomberg Ray Kelly way was ended, but he still supported, de Blasio did, what's called broken windows policing, sometimes still controversial. Why do you bring up broken windows policing, which is a policing practice rather than physical infrastructure in the context of your book?
You know, I bring it up because if you look at the original broken windows argument that has been called the Bible of the criminal justice system, the inspiration for stop and frisk and zero tolerance policing, if you really look at it closely, you find that the argument begins with the idea that this process begins where houses get abandoned, windows get broken, then you get graffiti and the disorder. For some reason,
that larger crime, more serious crime, follows the small crime, like the graffiti and the broken windows, because people get used to thinking that disorder will not be prosecuted.
That's right. They perceive the neighborhood to be a place where no one's in control. And so that program became the justification for zero tolerance policing, which has been so destructive for so many communities in this city and beyond. But the truth is, we failed to recognize the very simple beginning of that idea. If a house is abandoned, if a window is broken, what if we just repaired them? So recently, and I write about this in the book, one of the most exciting experiments in the social sciences comes from a guy named Charles Brannis. He was at Penn, he's now at Columbia in epidemiology, and they have this multidisciplinary team that looked at the city of Philadelphia. They have tens of thousands of vacant lots, abandoned buildings. They experimented and said, what happens if you repair some of them, just fix them up, make them into nice pocket parks or board up the buildings? Well, what happens is remarkable. You get declines in violent crime and gun crime in particular of more than 30% compared to the places that weren't treated. And you reduce stress because when people walk by the treated places, they don't have their heart rates jump a beat. It's an incredible, so in other
do
words—
Do we still have enough of an abandoned, they're trying to use every space to build more housing in New York. Do we still have an abandoned building problem, and is the de Blasio administration not addressing it in the way you prescribe?
So I can't say specifically which, you know, what de Blasio is doing about abandoned buildings in New York City. And the book, I should say, has a lot to say about New York City because of my research here, but it also covers cities around the country and around the world. I do believe that there are neighborhoods in Brooklyn and the Bronx that still have abandoned houses and place and empty lots and places that need to be treated. But the larger point is there are hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of places like this around the country, and we can do so much more to reduce crime by treating those places as opposed to punishing people.
We'll take your calls for Eric Kleinenberg on social infrastructure right after this.
I'm Allison Stewart, and I'm excited to spend the afternoon with you as the host of a new show from WNYC called All of It with Allison Stewart. We'll dig into what culture reveals about the culture. We'll meet makers, doers, creators, and talk about the what and why of their work. The emerging and the established, the high and the low, the local and the global, all of it. Join me weekdays at noon, starting Monday on WNYC.
WNYC supporters include the New York Botanical Garden, featuring Georgia O'Keeffe, Visions of Hawaii, Rare Works reunited in New York for the first time since 1940, and the plants and flowers that inspired them, through October 28th, nybg.org. Glenn Mead, an independent trust company providing investment and wealth management services to families, endowments, and institutions. More from Lee Miller at 212-328-7331. The Town Hall, presenting NPR humorist and author David Sedaris live Friday, May 10th. Tickets available this Friday, September 14th at 10 a.m. Details at thetownhall.org.
Coming up at noon on Midday, CNN's and The New Yorker's legal analyst Jeffrey Toobin will be on to look at the political evolution of Rudy Giuliani. He has a big New Yorker article on Giuliani, does Jeffrey Toobin, so that's coming up at noon. Plus cartoonist Liana Fink talks about her new graphic memoir, Passing for Human, at noon on WNYC.
If you believe democracy requires a free press, your station is WNYC, 93.9 FM and AM 820, NPR News and the New York Conversation.
On WNYC with Eric Kleinenberg, director of the Institute for Public Knowledge at NYU, and author now of Palaces for the People, How Social Infrastructure Can Help Fight Inequality, Polarization, and the Decline of Civic Life. And Jim in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Brian. How are you? Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I am a huge fan.
Thank you.
I'm actually a teacher in the city, and I play your show all the time for my kids. What I was saying is one of the my biggest part of my infrastructure is I play poker in an underground club in Queens, and it's just a really great cross-section of people from across all walks of life and different political perspectives, and it's one of the places that it's, you know, I get a chance to get outside, I guess, of my bubble, and it's really hard to hate people up close, and I think one of the things that I tend to do with my wife and the people who are in my social circle normally is that you get into, you know, how can they possibly think this way? How can people possibly agree with this or possibly think this way? And it's kind of a chance to get outside of that and really see people who think that way and you get a sense of their perspective. And so I think it's been part of, I guess, my social infrastructure.
Do you find that liberals or conservatives are better bluffers?
Well, I got to say, it's primarily populated by older white guys who are retired, so it's primarily mostly Republicans and conservatives.
And they're better bluffers?
Yeah, probably so.
Jim, thank you very much. Seth in Pearl River, you're on WNYC. Hello, Seth.
Hello, how are you?
Good. You have a question, I see.
Yes, the question goes to the sort of fabric of that social space. You know, how does the notion or does the notion of like an aleatory space roll into it? Meaning, you know, are these familiar spaces? Are these unfamiliar spaces? And how does that aid or not the sort of generation of that social fabric? You know, you think.
You got cut off at the end there, but you got the question.
It's a cool question. I think when we have a place where we go often, We're open to establishing relationships. You know, some of my favorite social science studies focus on things like child care centers, where people go on a regular basis and, you know, not only get a place where their child can get taken care of, but also very quickly grow to develop trusting relationships with other people who are in their situation. It's remarkable, if you've ever had a child in a place like this, how quickly parents start taking care of one another's kids, the most valuable thing in the world that we entrust immediately. If you go to a playground and you push the swing regularly, you're comfortable there, and you're just as likely to build a long-term relationship in a place like that as anywhere else in the world. Of course, there are other places that we can go to and that are new and different, and we can happen to meet someone with whom we share connections. But I think you're making a great insight. Regular places matter.
Gowan and White Plains, you're on WNYC with Eric Kleinenberg. Hi, Gowan.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call, Brian. So I'm an Episcopal priest, and one of the things that I've noted is that the congregations and other not-for-profits sometimes fill in some of the gaps that have been eroded as public institutions have deteriorated. And I'm wondering what you think about how various not-for-profits fit within that, you know, how they can develop social infrastructure. I'll take this question off the air.
Thanks. I'm so glad you asked that question, because there's a lot of material in the book about the role of nonprofits and religious organizations as well as social infrastructures. Of course, they can only operate that way if they have a physical place that people can reliably attend. And yet there are many that do. We know from research that nonprofits make a tremendous impact on the quality of life of neighborhoods. They can reduce crime. They can expand longevity even. It's timely, I think, given the hurricane that's likely going to hit the East Coast of the United States this week, for me to mention that the chapter that's about climate change and resilience focuses on the work of a set of churches in Houston that did tremendous work to provide relief not only to their own congregants but also to neighbors in the aftermath of Harvey not long ago. There's a church called Wilchrist Baptist Church that famously did a lot of outreach to try to create a multi-ethnic congregation, and that can be a real issue, right? Churches can segregate as much as they unite, but when a religious organization or any nonprofit makes an effort to be inclusive, they can help a great number of people.
We had another social commentator on recently who said one of the problems contributing to the polarization in the country today, in his opinion, is that we've moved away from private community definers of community, like religious institutions and other civic organizations that de Tocqueville once upon a time saw as so unique and crucial to the American experiment, to this moment when politics so defines our community, which winds up polarizing rather than bringing together. Do you share that critique at all?
Well, I mean, yes, I think that's an issue, but I think that we can overstate the extent to which most of us are involved in those heated political debates. There's a world of pundits and experts who are dominating the public conversation, and then there's a world of citizens who live very different lives. So many of us spend our days in schools and libraries, attend parks or religious organizations, or even go to workplaces where we discuss other kinds of things. So we are more polarized than others. We are more polarized than we've been before. I mean, it's an amazing moment when the kind of coffee you drink can say what your politics are. But at the same time, I think there are ways for us to productively engage each other.
Tricia in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Tricia, we have 20 seconds for you. Hi.
Farmers markets, dog runs, community gardens, green squares, flea markets, public arts like the gates, bioswales, and getting rid of the bad LED lighting that is very antisocial on the streets that they're putting in the city. It's very harsh, and the AMA says it's not good for you.
That was the best used 20 seconds in the history of the show.
Thank you,
Tricia.
Thank you.
And out of that list, you wanted to single out something about community gardens, if you can do it in 15 seconds.
Absolutely. They can solve the problem of food deserts and provide produce in places that need them, but that most crucially, they bring people from different generations together to build the kind of relationships we all need to get by.
30 seconds. Is social media social infrastructure?
It isn't. It's part of a communication system. It's a great way to learn what loud people have to say or to connect with friends.
It was supposed to be, right? I mean, I remember the early days of the web where it was the new tool for community building for people, especially who are isolated in other ways.
It was going to solve the problem of journalism and the problem of democracy, but I think we know what happened there. I'm very concerned that social media can pull us away from the face-to-face interactions that we need so much because it keeps us from being where we are and with the people who are with us.
Eric Kleinenberg's book is Palaces for the People, How Social Infrastructure Can Help Fight Inequality, Polarization, and Decline of Civic Life. If you want to see him in person, tomorrow night at the Strand in conversation with Dorian Warren. Tomorrow night, 7:30, Eric Kleinenberg at the Strand. Thank you so much.
So nice to be here. Thank you.